This is Homefront South Dakota, and can you just give me your name and age?
I was going by the army. I'm Cornelius and Charles Anderson, but I go by Charles or Charlie all the time here.
And how old are you?
I'm 86.
And what is your hometown?
My hometown now is Oral, South Dakota.
And where were you
And
born, or where did you grow up?
when was I born? I was in July the 18th of 1921. I was born in a little town of Hay Springs, Nebraska.
Could you give me your branch of service and rank in the unit you served with?
Yes, I was in what they call the Army Air Force. And that was before they changed to the regular Air Force. And I was a got my wings in November 42, but I was a teacher for 14 months, right? A chance to go overseas. And I got with the crew, and the last part of 44, we started overseas. And in that time, we was the first mission I had was Brussels, Belgium, and it sounded like a hailstorm on a roof, a tin roof. I said, "Ooh, there's something else going on," and I learned afterwards that we had some pretty rough times. In fact, one of them was it's either the third time or the fourth time we hit the ball bearing plant in Swinford. And that time, while we lost 36 planes, our high formation was completely wiped out. We had 156 holes in our plane by the time we got home. And I had one of the first missions. I went past Berlin, and I was on the fourth mission. It did have a full group that to hit Berlin, and out of my 14th missions, we hit Berlin. I was on that for six missions. On May the 19th, as was coming into Berlin, why an aircraft got us. It blew such a big hole in our wing, it burned rather than a blow, or I wouldn't be here today. And another one went in the waist, and I shot the waist gunners up, and another one went off and blew part of the tail, another left horizontal stabilizer off. And as soon as the fire started, I was sitting on my flak suits saying my prayers, and they looked down, and I saw the smoke, and tried to call the pilot, and I couldn't get him. And I looked kind of over my shoulder back, and then I looked, and we had six fog wolves on our tail. And then the fire was gone about 100 yards past our tail. And so I said, "This is it." I started to crawl around my tail wheel. And as far as my gas mask, an oxygen mask would let me. And then I yanked it off and crawled the rest of the way and grabbed this little cable that holds the pins in the hinges, and I kicked that door off and I bailed out. And by that time I ran out of oxygen. I guess I passed out for a little while, and when I come to, I was still kind of rolling, and so I pulled my chute, and boy, I think I was hitting 150 mile an hour. It, bam, boy, it threw me up, and well, my gloves flew off, and I don't know what all, and I sailed down. I bailed out between right at 21 to 24,000 feet, and that's about 5 miles in the air. And I landed in a little grove of trees, and I hid out towards evening, and then I got up and started to move. And their timber is rather, they have it pretty clean, and but they have areas that like a road that goes through, and they put a guard on the end. Well, I saw the guard, and I turned it around, and I walked by, and that second one is no guard. The third one, I didn't see nobody, and I crossed, and somebody said, "Halt." And I waved to him and started walking. And then the next time, it was the biggest old gun you ever wanted to look at, pointed at me. So I threw my hands up and gave up. And first thing he says, I asked him for water. Bosser, Bosser, oh yeah. And I said, you took English? And he says, yeah. He says, I've been in your states a few times. And we started to, he said so many to, that kilometers was to water, and we started. And I had a pack and a half of cigarettes on me, and we carried him a count. If we didn't, I, that time we wasn't getting much like that over in Europe and in England. And that the guys would steal them otherwise. And he said, cigarette. Well, I gave him a cigarette and didn't want 100 yards and another cigarette. Well, he smoked my half a pack, opened up, and he started the other pack. We got to this town. He turned me into the burgomaster, or that, the mayor, and he's running a little bar, and they had a kind of a little cupola back, and they set me down there by a table, and he sat across. And about that time, this room just filled up with people. And I guess they hadn't seen too many of us airmen at that time. And one woman started making a motion that I kill women and children. And he got up and stuck his finger in her face and told her off. And then everything settled down. And then they loaded me, finally the Luftwaffe, that's their place, loaded me up on the sidecar on the motorcycle, and we ended up on the prettiest air bases I ever saw in my life. And then everything, the floors and everything was marble and everything. And they interviewed me there, and then they put me into a cell for the night. Next morning, they lined six of us up along the line, and my radio operator was standing beside me, and I said to my man, I said, how many got out? And this guard come over and called my name, pulled his Luger out and stuck it right up in my mouth. And I just didn't stare him down, and he pulled it down, and that's it. And then they loaded us on a truck, and we ended up in Berlin. And they put us on a baggage car, and we had to stand up in it and hang on to each other. So, and I saw one place where we stopped where a bomb had hit. It might have been our bomb because we toggled it. But otherwise, I never saw one building hit in that whole town that was hit by a bomb. Everything was in contact as it was. They took me to, we ended up into a transportation center that was probably 150 of us airmen there, and we was there, and by 1 o'clock they come in with a 5 gallon of soup for us, and 3 bowls and 3 spoons. Well, you didn't need the spoons because it's so thin, so we would drink the soup and hand it back and stuff, and it took a couple hours to get them all fed. And then he come over and he says, come, and he took two of us out. And we was to wash this kettle out and the bowls. And as we was walking to come into this territory, it's like a big room, like big as it's a very large room. And it was just like foot lockers clear around this and the whole square. And then it's about 15 foot was another square of these. And as he's walking down, I heard a moaning in one of them. And the guard went over and opened the door and cussed him out and busted him in the face with his fist and locked the door. Here was a human in it. And I thought, boy, they're going to have to kill me because I'm never going into that. We watched that. That evening, they loaded us on the train, and it took 3 days to go down, and we ended up down at Frankfurt. And then they loaded us on trucks and went to Wetzlar, and there's where we went to. All the airmen got interrogated. And they put us down in little cells down below, and there's about 6 by 8. And we sat there, and until they thought they'd soften you up. And I was in 3 days and two nights, and my one third evening when they took me up, threw a paper out in front of me and said, we want you to fill this out. So I put my name, my rank, and serial number, and handed it back to him. He says, "You never finished it." I says, "I don't have to." And I says, "That's all I have to give." And before then, I was interrogated, and he wrote down a piece of paper, and he took this paper and read it, and he says, two guards is on each side. He says, "Get him out of here before I kill him." So they grabbed me by the shoulder, arms, and out we went. And I said, "Well, this is another day that's going to die." And instead of that, they threw me into a room. And that evening, why they put me in transportation. Then they loaded us all up, and we started to go northeast. And they would travel at night. And then they don't hook their engine. We would give them terminals in the daytime, and they knew that the Allies was bombing these terminals. And we saw them bomb within a block of our train. And we finally, it took 10 days before we got to our base. And we was the first 400 in this new base. And when we come in, they took our clothes off, and give us our prisoner clothes. And I got a pair of blue wool pants and a chamois shirt and a pair of shoes that fit. And then they gave us a one blanket and a burlap bag and a bowl and a cup and a knife, fork, and spoon. And then as we went down, why to go out, why they handed us a little, the Red Cross handed us a little kind of a satchel, and it had all the toilet articles and stuff in it. As we went into our compound, why they called your name and to go to that barracks. And then as you went in, there's no one told you what bed you had. And I ended up in clear at the end in number 5 barracks. And number 10 room, and I got the bed right by the window. And no more, and we sat down, and they said, "Come," and we went out. And this is Excelsior; it's kind of like wood stuff. And I went out, and we start filling this bag up. And this old guard, he'd come up and say, "Nix, nix, nix," and you'd have to stop. And that was your mattress, and your springs is 6 1x6s is laid far apart. That was your spring, and the one back, and that was your home. And then every morning, why they'd open the door, and we'd get hot coffee. Then we'd have roll call. If somebody was hiding out or something, you stood until they found him. I stood as high as 4 hours out there waiting for him. And then at 10 o'clock, the bread truck come in, and this bread, at that time, we finally ended up with 24 boys in a room, about 16 by 20 or something like that. And this bread was about the size of a pound loaf of bread, and we got 1.5 for 24 boys. And then at noon, we got what we call a dehydrated cabbage soup. This soup would look like soap bars, and they'd have to soak it all up and make a kind of a brown soup out of it. And at night we got potatoes. That was your main menu. Once in a while we'd get some greens, and they smelled just like cat manure, and you had to hold your nose eating. And like they said out here, said, "And you got to eat some, you got to eat horse meat." Yeah, I got horse meat 3 times in the summer, and that was meat that was too ripe for the people to eat, so we got it. In fact, one time we got it, and the little white things floating on top, and you're hungry enough, you ate them. In the summertime, we finally ended up playing, we got They brought in quite a little sporting equipment. They couldn't bring us in no Red Cross food, but their sporting equipment. So we started to play softball, and we'd bet on it and stuff. And then when it got cold, why, they started playing cards. We had one card, deck of cards, but you took one out, the ace of hearts, and we made one out of cardboard, and you knew that was ace of hearts. And but I started, whittle, being an old farm boy, I started to make a little farmstead out of wood. First, I made a barn, then I made a house, and then I thought, well, I better put some trails around it and there's some fences. So I started a whittle. I'd sit there for hour after hour and I'd whittle these out. And as time went by, we had to come in. They would always come in about midnight, 4 o'clock, and they'd say, "Rouse," and I mean, get out of here, you know. And at that time, in the winter time, why, we had a lot of snow, and of course, guys walking on it, you know, you 2,400 guys on a half a block size of our, and why, it's about 6, 8 inches of ice, and they'd run you out there barefooted on that, and they'd stand and on it. Sometimes it'd be out there an hour or so. And this one underfelt label, a sergeant, he'd say, "Go, boys, I'll take care of this room." And he'd get this out and he'd studied it all over and see how much more I did. So the guys, they'd steal wood all over and bring it to me to do it because our room wasn't getting tore up so bad. Because otherwise, they'd rip every mattress open. And then they'd break your bowls and everything like that. Just be ornery, I guess. And so I ended up, I think I had 8 buildings and a lot of little fence and stuff. And I folded them up and I brought them home. And when the house burned down, I lost them. And we was in this camp, and then there was only 400 of us until way after the invasion. And then they started to come in, and we had 6,000 that come from up at East Prussia. They come in, and by the time that the 1st of February, while we had, or 1st of January, we had 10,000 in this camp. And they said they shipped out 1,500 casuals. The boys just shot up, and my radio operator's one of them that went out, and few of, and took them to another camp, and then the last ones that's in the best shape, they loaded them up and hauled them out. But this old timer sat there, and see, I've been there 9 months at that time. And February 8th, they says, "Take your blankets, we're moving out." And so we took our blanket and we started to move out. And we was behind the Russian lines, I guess, a ways, and we walked as high as 35 miles for about 4 days, every day 35 miles. Slept out in the woods and mud, snow, and everything else. No food, and the only water we had was to eat the snow and everything. And then as we got, and as we kept going, why, they would, we would sleep in barns, we'd sleep in anything. And the only time they'd ever find, give us anything to eat was every time we'd go by a cooker and they would trip a handle on it. And this is made for their, make their whole food and stuff with. And the potatoes roll out, and you reach, walk by as you picked, you stopped, you got kicked in the butt, and you're getting your hands and knees in time you got out of there, so you get up, you had nothing but the skin left. So we, you'd probably get the old 4 or 5 potatoes, and that would last probably about once a week would happen. Otherwise, we had to steal everything we ate. We would, they would feed the cows, and we could get by. Why, we would sneak in, we'd steal about cow food, the hog food the same way. The cow food, we'd put it in our pockets, and two, the hogs, it was a slop, so we couldn't hardly do it, but we'd eat it too, or anything we could. And our guards wouldn't let us drink the fresh water, so we drank the water in the ditches, and that was coming from cow barns and hog barns and everything too. And so some of the boys frosted their feet. Some, in about 3 or 4 days, was gangrene set in, they was dead. And some of them would get pneumonia, 24 hours is dead. And then about 80% of us got this, we got dysentery. And the bug was just ate us up. And I was doing pretty good until about the middle of March. And boy, I got, oh, I just really had it bad in 10 days. And I was lagging behind a little and had it stick. And these guards kept hitting me in one spot of my back. And they never hit me in the kidneys. They never hit you on the backbone. And there was that nerve that went to your legs. And my right leg is dying today. But anyway, and finally, one day, boy, they called us all out and they said, "We want you, and get on them wagons. You can't keep up. But sit on the side." So we sat on the side. And all of a sudden here they come out with four boys that couldn't set up anymore and carried them like a sack of potatoes and just threw them in the bottom of the wagons. Well, this one boy, he was in barracks too. He come in the same time I did, and he opened his eyes up and he said, "I don't want to die. Please help me. I don't want to die." His hand dropped and he's dead. And I couldn't tell that story for a long time. But they put us in this barn, and I know they put us in there just to die. Well, in that summer, we got a few cigarettes, and I saved them and saved and saved. And we had one boy, he had a wool shirt, an army shirt. I don't know where he got it, where it was, or anything, how come he had it on. But he had it on, and he wanted to trade that for some cigarettes, so I did. And I had this shirt on, and I went out and relieved myself, and I said, "It's getting first April," and I thought, "I wonder if I can trade this shirt for some cheese." So I took it off, shook it out the best I could, and tried to shake some of the cooties out and stuff. But anyway, I shouldn't say it. But anyway, and I took it over to the dairy barn, and I asked I could talk enough German, and I said, if I could trade this shirt for some cheese. And he came out, he had this brick of cheese about 8 inches square. And I come back, and the boy's in my room too, and he was real bad. And I said, "Look, Larry, we got some cheese. Let's eat it." He said, "No, Andy, you eat it." He says, "I'm going to die anyway." He says, "You eat the cheese." I said, "Like heck you are. You're going to eat this cheese." We ate that cheese, and 3 days' time, we got stopped. And we ended up finally, cleared the Rhine River, and went into English Line. We was there just 2 days, and they called us out, and they started to count us out, and they went to Einsfeld Drive here from Fenton, and that's 10, up to 10. And I think I was 10 and I fell out, and I fell out with quite a few of these English boys, and they've been down for quite some time. So they was taken on Dunkirk, and they've been prisoners for about 4 years. And it was the luckiest thing in the world because they knew how to get food. And we started back. And we was back, we got back to across the Elbe River and just back, east of Lunenburg, about 6 kilometers, I suppose. And they put us in a hay barn, and they put their artillery around this barn, which they always done, seemed like. And they had about a 2 or 3 day artillery duel, and they knew. See, if the Allies had hit that barn and knocked the artillery out, they'd kill us. And that's why they did it and knew it. So finally, on that one morning, boy, off they went. So I don't know where they was going, because just 6 kilometers east of us was Russians. And then that afternoon, we got liberated. And we walked about 600 miles, and we was on the road for 84 days. They call it the Black March of Death, March of Germany, if you ever want to hunt it up, that's what it is. And they took us back to a little transportation tents, and there's where we were when the Germans signed the peace treaty. And 5 days afterwards, why, they was running us through, and they had a tendency, the bread had come in your camp, why, they lined their bread pans with the sawdust, and they put chipped glass in it, and you had to be careful of that. And our room chief said, watch your boys, you better scrape it off, it's glass today. And fume got it in there, and it settled down into their colon, and they found it. And so they was running us through, testing us, and they stepped on the scale, and I weighed 85 pounds. And this English doctor, as I say, is a regular army doctor, he says, are you married? I said, no, but I plan on it. And he was like that, and I says, what? And he says, you're not going to make it home. I thought, well, you son of a gun, I'll show you I'm going to make it home. And I did. I made it home.
Do you remember when you were liberated, what some of your first thoughts were, what how you felt?
I was still, you're kind of numb, and I just didn't feel like I was still a prisoner. I'll tell you the truth of it, I did. I was kind of free, too, because you went down there, and we got to ride a truck instead of walking that time and stuff like that. Yeah, I noticed that. But as far as I had the feeling that our government treated us POWs like they should have, because we was in this camp, and we weren't allowed to talk to any of the the Germans or anybody. But the then they shipped in what they call the troops, and they could go around stuff. But as POWs weren't allowed to do that at all. And as we got on, was in this camp, and all we thought about is eating, I tell you the truth of it. And we just ate the day English almost out of food. But then we got on the old Lancaster, and we went to Brussels, Belgium. There we had a small area where it could go. And then we got on the train. There was an English guards on us. And when that was stopped, there was American guards on us. They shipped us down to a Lucky Strike camp. That was where all of the American airmen, POWs, was. And there was a third of them was guards down there over us. And I was there for 2 months, and they fed me up, and I got on the train. And when I hit the States, I was very disillusioned, because we got there, and it took them all day to unload this boat, because it's going to the area you was going to. I was going to Minneapolis, because my wife lived there, you know. And you come off single file on that gangplank. There's a line of SPs told you to keep moving into this warehouse. And there we got our new uniforms and everything. Threw it over our neck bags, over our shoulder. Went out, and there's another line. Robed MPs told to keep moving and get on that train. That's the way I was treated when I come home. I planned on making it the Army as my Air Force as my career, but that spoiled me. Only trouble was, 3 years later, I did get a registered letter. I could come back as a teacher on my and I told my wife I'm going back to service, and she said she talked me out of it. I keep myself since then.
So you're when you look back through the years, how do you think the experience of being a POW affected the rest of your life?
Oh, it definitely did, because one item is that anytime anybody starts pushing you around, you just revolt to beat heck. In fact, you get kind of mean. And another item, I hate to be alone, especially at night. And any little noise in the house or anything, because they come in, and you'd hear the thump and it's time to get out. And any noise at all. When I first come home, I would be out of bed and I was hiding. And I have a little tendency to be that way yet. If I hear a little noise and stuff, I get up and look. And it affects you all the time. And as far as you're forgetting, you never forget. And you can always see these boys, it's going down or something like that, because we lost so many planes. And you'd see them blowing up in midair, and then you see them doing down and all that. And a lot of times tonight, that flashes right back to you. And you never get over it.
You mentioned that you wished you would have become a teacher again for the Air Force.
Yeah.
Why is that?
I was a sighting instructor. I taught all the sights on all the bombers, and how the nomenclature, how to use them, the negative shooting, the positive shooting, and all of this. And I would have went back on my old rating, and probably no time I'd been a couple more stripers. And I enjoyed it myself. And when I was teaching, when we first started, the war was just really getting started. And they had to have gunners, and in my class, there's only 70 of us in it. And by the time that we was shipping out, we was probably running 400 boys through a day in that school. And there's schools all over the U.S. And I guess I was considered one of the top teachers, because we'd have some of them instructors that get a little trouble with their boys, and that's my job to go and straighten them out.
But you decided not to go back in the service partly because of how you were treated.
Yes, that was right. It was definitely just like, they shipped us down to Kelly Field, and first thing they did is go out and we want you guys going to have to pick up the cigarette butts and stuff, just like with recruits and all this. And then I was shipped up to Madison, Wisconsin, worked in an orderly room there. And I first come in, a captain says, "You're going to have to work underneath that boy." I says, "No, he works under me." Here he's a little corporal, and he's going to put a staff over him, under him. And none of them would talk to me or anything. They were so obnoxious, it's pitiful. And I think it's because I don't know if they're scared of me, or if they was envious or something, because none of them had ever been overseas.
Charlie, what helped you get over some of those memories and flashbacks, even though you never forget them? What helped you kind of regain a normal way of life again after you came back?
Work. Yeah, I did. I put myself into work and my family pretty much. Yeah.
Is there anything else you'd like to share before we close tape?
I think I pretty well covered it all myself. There's a few items I'd think about, and I'd say it again, But I think that our camp, I heard that this colonel was taken in for by him said court-martial for the way he treated us. And because it was all uncalled for. When you're on the road for 84 days and you're just sleeping everywhere and no food, no water, and anything that you could do, I mean it, and it affected you. And as far as our camp was, it was very strict on us. I remember one time we had it's the winter time, and this one boy, he kind of went berserk, and he took a notion that he's going to crawl the fence and go into the other compound where his crew was. And they waited till he shot it. He got up on clear on top, and then he opened a machine gun and shot him. And they left him there for almost 10 days, his frozen body. And they said, this is what you get if you don't mind us. And that old colonel would say that every morning. See that body? This is what you get if you don't mind us.
How did it feel knowing that the colonel was tried for war crimes? Was that any comfort to you?
No. No. Tell you the truth of it, maybe by him sometimes I think they should have run all of us POWs through a psychologist and worked on us, but there was no one. Then, in fact, all of us airmen, a bunch of us airmen was down there in Lucky Strike camp, and the captain come, and they blew the whistle, all come down. He got up, and this is what hurt. He says, when you go home, forget your experience. He says, because we don't believe your stories, and the people won't believe your stories. That hurt. And the only reason I found out afterwards that they wanted Germany to be an ally, and it took the German. They knew if we told all of our stories, that probably the civilians would kind of go against it, and they couldn't have that. They took the German side over the POWs.
That would be the worst.
It hurt. It hurt when it happened. In fact, my sons knew that I had been a POW, but they didn't know no stories about me for years. And the only reason I got started, we had a little a Chinese girl and her folks as prisoners one time. And she was a volunteer up at the VA. And she says one time, says, Charlie, let's start a round table discussion with the prisoners. And we get this. And they'd always say, I don't know, remember nothing. Well, all of a sudden, they'd an hour and a half to tell the whole story. And I'd tell a little. And so one day she called me up, says, Charlie, come town. I got something for you. So I come town. She's up the VA and get in. So I got in the car, went in, there's a little group there by, and she's down. She says, Charlie was a POW, now he's going to tell some of his stories. And I got started to tell him. And then all of a sudden, I had a neighbor boy. He had only 30 songs. I didn't a prisoner, but he was a neighbor boy. And he got to be a professor in Shadburn State College, and he retired in. We got to traveling together, and we traveled probably 30 or more schools that we talked to. And we went clear down south of Torrington, Wyoming, clear up to Churches, South Dakota. And he passed away. I haven't talked to a school now for 2 years. But I think this, yes, I have. I had a second. Third cousin, I guess, and he called me up down around Grand Island, Nebraska, wanted me to come down and talk to school, and I went down there about 2 months ago, talked to him.
That's great. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I even talked to sergeants in air base up here. And they say, how come you could get a sergeant in 2 or 3 months in the service? I said, they didn't give us what we knew. They give us because of our nerves. Just like when we lined up to go to gunnery school, this officer come out and he said, well, I'm going to tell you boys right now, your life is only worth 18 seconds in combat. If you think it's worth more than that, you better fall out. I thought, gee, that sounds exciting, so I stayed.
Wow.
At that time, you know, it's all it's worth.
Oh. Well, I guess we should.
Did you ever talk? Did I?
Oh, not at all. Not at all. Is there anything else you'd like to say before we end, or?
Well, not much. I'm just happy to be alive, I'll tell you the truth of it. And as far as my health, I think I'm healthier than the average person. And nearly all, and I like with my crew, my pilot, navigator, and me are the only ones alive. And in our camp, my room chief we had, he was from Valentine, Nebraska, luck would have it. And he had all the names of all the boys, the 24 in a room. And he tried to get in contact with them, and he got with eight. And they're all dead now, except one. And he lives on the East Coast in Massachusetts, and we go back and talk, but the rest of them all passed away. In fact, a lot of them prisoners died within a few years after they got home, and many of them were mentally bad too.
Well, that's understandable. I mean,
Yeah, and so it bothers. It bothers you in a lot of ways. I'm into yet, and I have a tendency to talk quite a little anymore because of my nerves are bad. I go into this what they call feedback, and you're supposed to be down maybe 15 and stuff, and I run to 70 and 80 all the time because it's in there and I can't break it.
How do you feel now on a daily basis? Still kind of.
Oh yeah, you're always that way. You could just jump up and bang your head on the ceiling and still because it really does bother you. Yeah. And I still at night I wake up I get a lot of dreams a lot of times, It isn't exactly like it happened, but it's something that matches it or something. And you wake up. And sometimes it'd be so bad I'd get up and I'll sit in my chair and read a while, stuff like that, because it really hits you.
Well, Charlie, thank you very much for
Oh,
sharing.
thank you.
I really appreciate it.